This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Christian Inouye signs his first bill into law, repealing the permit requirement to carry a concealed weapon. The state Senate acts on school choice bills and some on campaign finance. And former St. Paul School student Owen LaBrie returns to court seeking a new trial. Good day. All this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we start with Governor Sununu's bill signing, repealing concealed carry. Allie, Paul, we were all there. It was a festive moment for gun rights activists who have seen similar bills pass to be vetoed by Democratic governors. And the governor's office was acting like this was a big political win for him, too, weren't they?
Yeah, you know, I think it was. That you could tell by the atmosphere. There were dozens of supporters there. And it comes, a week after Governor Sununu suffered a big loss with when Right to Work went down, which was one of his big priorities. And this bill is one that Republicans have been pushing hard in recent years, and it basically makes the permitting process to carry a concealed gun optional instead of mandatory. And, some of the arguments had been that former state law, police chiefs got to determine who was, quote, suitable to carry a concealed gun. And critics hated that because they said it made the process too subjective and police might be abusing the process, which it's hard to come by any evidence of that, just given there is no statewide tracking system of these licenses. But Republicans are pretty happy with this. New Hampshire becomes the 11th state to move forward on this permitless carry. And I think Governor Sununu does consider it a big one.
Why don't we take a listen to what he said as he signed the bill?
This is about safety. This is about making sure that our laws and our books are keeping people safe while remaining true to that live free or die spirit that makes New Hampshire the great state that it is.
That was Governor Sununu as he signed his first bill into law, repealing concealed carry. You know, this wasn't something he talked about a great deal on the campaign trail. He certainly always indicated he would sign it. This was something that, you know, Republican primary voters were certainly looking to hear from candidates on. Where to from here in terms of gun rights? I was talking to a bunch of the people at the signing, and, you know, some of them, when I said, well, you know, what's next here, or is this the kind of end of the line? And I doubt it's ever really the end of the line on an issue like that. Some of them, they were kind of scratching their heads and certainly feeling good about where the state stands now and this law is in effect right now.
This may be it for this session, but, you and I, when we were there, as well as Allie, it was kind of interesting to the Sununu administration. A bunch of the officials were capturing the moment with their own video, with their own pictures. I think they wanted to make this into maybe a little more than it was because they didn't get Right to Work. As you said, he talked about it on the campaign trail, but this was never issue number one for Chris Sununu. But because they didn't get the other bill on Right to Work, this one is kind of being touted as a major, major victory. I don't think it was ever in doubt. It did get through the state Senate. We knew that. And it was a 2-1 margin in the state House. So, yes, it becomes law. Yes, it's a victory for the Sununu administration, but there are bigger tests ahead.
But it's interesting. We talked about Governor Sununu's electoral strategy. He didn't really mention Right to Work all that much. He didn't mention concealed or constitutional carry all that much. He talked about wanting to run a general election strategy, even in the primaries, to kind of see how this would all play out. Now that he's in the governor's office and he sees how important these particular two issues are to conservatives, he's approached them with a lot more energy. This is no doubt, this is a big one for conservatives. Every election I can remember in recent memory here at whatever level of government, Second Amendment rights always come up among conservatives. And so, this is a good win for him in terms of building political capital with Republicans. And there's just been so much pent up energy over this over the years with Democratic governors always blocking it.
Well, then technically, as you say, Allie, it takes away the mandatory permit, but it allows people to seek permits so as to enjoy reciprocity that New Hampshire has with other states. And how many states is that roughly?
I think we have about eight About 15, 18 states that we do have reciprocity with. And I think to your point about where we go next, New Hampshire is already an open carry state, meaning if you can legally own a gun, you can carry it exposed. And this concealed carry kind of puts carrying concealed in line with that. And I'm not sure. Republicans have been fighting so hard for this for such an extended number of years. I don't know if they have set the next goalpost for where they want to go.
Well, it was interesting. This was something that certainly, victories like this in a state house are celebrated nationally. It was interesting. There was a fellow up from the NRA from Washington, posing for pictures with the governor, with the bill's lead sponsor, Jeb Bradley. He was spending a lifetime talking to him. One thing, I was talking to a lawyer who's represented people who have challenged permit denials, and he said one of the issues that he thought interesting is that opponents of this bill and supporters of the past policy had never taken the effort to introduce a bill to create essentially a test for the suitable person language, which, was at issue in a 2013 Supreme Court case, and the court essentially ruled that, state law didn't really define what a suitable person was, but did suggest that police chiefs needed some discretion on this, and that, according to some in the gun rights movement, really, motivated the last several years of debate on this issue. But, Democrats have never really tried to create a legal test for the suitable person language, which, may speak to, their electoral strategy, which has historically been like, let's leave gun rights alone because that's a loser for us. That's kind of past mm-hmm. the boards now. But, do you think this helps Chris Sununu with conservatives? Because talking to some conservatives there, why don't we listen to what John Burt, he was one of the sponsors of the bill, what he said after the vote?
After this is huge for him. He's going to have all of the conservatives, gun rights people, everybody is going to support him from here on out. This was a huge win for Governor Sununu.
All right, that was Representative John Burt of Goffstown talking about the great things this is going to mean for Governor Sununu. I'm sure Governor Sununu hopes so, but, I'll cut Representative Burt some slack. He was very happy that his bill became law, but do you think that this means that conservatives are going to be with Chris Sununu, hell or high water from here on out, anybody?
It doesn't hurt. I don't think there was going to be a serious primary challenge against Chris Sununu next year. And between Frank Edelblue now and his own administration and this, it kind of prevents that from happening. It's a preventive measure, I guess you could say.
I mean, I don't think it really I don't think this bill was ever in doubt. I mean, Chris Sununu had said he was going to sign it. Republicans in control of the legislature have passed it before. It sort of seemed like a done deal. And I think there's many bumps ahead as we get going on the state budget process. I think some of the things that Governor Sununu has outlined in his proposal may face some opposition from Republicans in the House, maybe in the Senate. And I don't know that signing a concealed carry bill is going to make that go away.
You're already hearing grumbling on the spending in the budget, almost a million more than the previous budget. Some conservatives are quietly coming up to reporters like us and talking about that.
Okay, well, we're going to holster the gun issue in a moment, but I do have an email from Kyle from Berlin. He says he definitely agrees with the gun bill. I live in a small city, Berlin, and everyone knows everyone. So let's say our police chief somewhat knows you or thinks he knows you because of who your family is and doesn't like them. He could use that to deny you the permit. That's one side of this. Certainly, police say that it's good to know who's carrying, helps them make decisions. But I would also heard lots of talk from people saying that, police always, they're trained to be ready and they're going to need to be ready. They already do need to be ready.
Well, and one thing that I think is kind of interesting is Maine, our neighbor, enacted a similar policy 2 years ago. But in their bill, they put some restrictions. So the permitless carry would only apply to people over age 21. And there was...
You're not supposed to go to bars, right?
I'm not sure.
I don't think you're supposed to. I believe there's a restriction on permitless carrying, like in taverns.
But part of it, too, is that if you get pulled over by a police officer and you are carrying a concealed gun, you're supposed to notify that officer. And I don't think neither of those provisions are in New Hampshire's law regarding age or a notification provision.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to some other action at the State House? The State Senate acted on a lot of bills yesterday. A big one was what's become known as the Croydon bill that cleared the Senate on party lines yesterday. Essentially lets town use taxpayer money for tuition for private schools when they don't have a school. There's kind of a backstory here. In Croydon, what is that, Paul?
The backstory, of course, is this argument's been going on for about 2 years now, and the State Department of Education nixed their plan to send five students to a nearby Montessori school because there was no similar school in their vicinity in their district for that class. It's become a rallying point for school choice activists. Then candidate for governor Chris Sununu talked about Croydon a lot on the campaign trail. Maybe he didn't talk about concealed carry that much, but he did talk about Croydon, as did Frank Edelblue and a bunch of other Republicans who were school choice advocates. Now this bill, which made it through the legislature last year but was vetoed by then Governor Hassan, this bill has a much better chance of becoming law now, and it would be a big feather in the cap for the governor, for conservatives, for school choice activists.
And we've talked in previous shows about how both at the national level with the confirmation of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education, and also with the change in control here of the governor's office, that this may be a good moment for school choice forces that have been kind of, you know, on their heels in recent years a little bit, but now there seems to be some opportunity for these kinds of legislation. And so I think you're going to see between the governor and Frank Edelblue as the commissioner a move toward legislation, and also certainly coming out of the State House, the legislature, legislation that provides kind of more flexibility or other options, or in part allows money to be used for school choice, and maybe not necessarily vouchers, but ways that kind of open up the options for families.
Another bill that did clear the Senate yesterday looks to allow families who worked with what are described as approved scholarship organizations to receive, you know, fully 90% of per pupil state grants. That's, I think it's around $3,500 at this point, to use for tuition or other costs associated with sending their child to any school or no school at all, homeschooling. And, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I think both of these bills have the potential to really change New Hampshire's education system. I think we've seen a growth in the number of families who are choosing to homeschool their children. And there has been, you know, Chris Sununu talked about this a lot on the campaign trail, dissatisfaction among parents he's heard from regarding the Common Core standards. And, you know, that argument would receive pushback from critics who say the standards are needed to ensure that every student is getting an adequate education. But I think, the Croydon bill, which as Paul mentioned, has passed, would let, school boards potentially give the state aid to DOE-approved private schools. And I'm not sure, what that criteria looks like at this point, if it's ever come up, what private schools might be approved by the Department of Education, which is now being led by Frank Edelblue. So if this does get through, I think that could be the next step. What are these types of private schools, and would this survive, a challenge on constitutional grounds?
Well, that's an interesting question in terms of the current educational tax scholarship program, which was challenged, was struck down by a Superior Court judge, and then on appeal, the Supreme Court upheld it, basically on the grounds that the people suing didn't have standing. So there hasn't really been a clean ruling on the constitutionality of the existing tax scholarship program, which allows businesses that donate scholarship money to receive tax credits. This bill that passed the Senate yesterday, seems to push that a step farther. And, challenge should this become law is pretty inevitable. But, you know, Governor Sununu has been pretty out there, as we've all said, and he has essentially said he would like to find a way to essentially allow students what is tantamount to vouchers.
There was also a vote yesterday, more symbolic, on another bill that would prohibit the implementation of Common Core. But you marry all these bills together, and it comes back to what we always say: elections have consequences. Republican governor, Republican-led legislature, this is what they talked about on the campaign trail. This is what they're implementing now.
Well, one thing that the Senate did yesterday that I thought was interesting was it voted 22-1 to fund full-day kindergarten at $14 million and then immediately to table it, which is something that often happens in budget years, the tabling of bills that have money attached to them to see how the policy shakes out. But it seems to indicate that a willingness among Republicans to take a little bit different approach than what the governor proposed in his budget. And we saw that reflected also in some of the comments he received when he presented his budget to the House last week. Any sense of, Allie, walking around the State House, that people are talking about, you know, moving beyond what the governor was envisioning, which was a targeted program based on need, to sort of a more straight up full day kindergarten?
So I think, to me, the vote yesterday kind of signals that Republicans are coming around to the idea of funding full-day kindergarten. It's one that hasn't gotten a lot of traction before Governor Sununu came into office and started proclaiming this as, you know, an important step in New Hampshire's education future. So to me, this shows that Republicans are on board with that vision. I think where we're going to see the problems is, as you mentioned, parsing out the dollars. And Governor Sununu in his budget has said he wants to spend $9 million, which is short of the full 14, to really send targeted grants to needy communities that might be trying to implement full-day kindergarten. But that's already faced questions from a member on the House Finance Committee who said, hey, we should be treating all school districts equally. Why would we pick one over the other? And why is one student worth more money than another?
And that was coming from a Republican, but it is a very kind of House position historically.
Yeah, and you heard that also from when Governor Sununu, after he presented his budget and his address, he came and testified in front of the joint committees, and a House Republican was asking him just that. To your point, I spoke to Jeb Bradley after the vote to table yesterday. And I said, you know, why are you doing this? And he talked about, yeah, this is a common practice. He is definitely in favor of full-day kindergarten, but again, they want to see where the money is when the budget comes over from the House.
And that is one area where we've heard from Democratic leadership they'd be very interested in doing something on kindergarten as well.
Well, one issue regarding the expansion of kindergarten, and NHPR did some reporting on this, is that, you know, some of this is tied to another debate, which is over state support of school building aid. And there are some schools that if you were going to expand kindergarten, you would need more space that you may not have the ability to raise. And so the money to raise, and it sort of adds to the cost. So, you know, all of these education things, I mean, you know, the governor likes to talk about creating pathways for students to achieve success. You know, there are a lot of moving parts that either, you know, collide or coalesce to create or block pathways.
Anyone who lives here in Concord and has followed the debate in the school board about whether or not to have full-day kindergarten in Concord, there's a whole range of considerations that you might not initially think of in terms of space, number of teachers, who's eligible. There was even suggestions that maybe you have like a preschool-type setup where people pay some tuition. It's an expense. It's much more expensive, I think, than people realize to ramp up something like that in a public school environment.
Well, there's definitely a potentially voting with your feet aspect of this. I happen to live in Hopkinton, which has full-day kindergarten, and my understanding is that it was sort of vastly underestimated how many people would potentially be participating in that, and whether that's you know, kind of in migration to go to a school district that has full-day kindergarten, happenstance, you know. Yeah. Children get born when they get born, but, you know.
And there's an interesting pedagogical discussion going on as well, not just about cost, but about whether or not it really makes a difference. You've heard some conservatives say that, you know, that by the second grade, any kind of benefits from a full day of kindergarten kind of wash out in terms of student performance, so that it you know, sort of, it really is more an issue of childcare options rather than some sort of actual developmental concern. So I hear that mixed in as well among people who oppose it.
Well, contemplating the decay of any information that one receives and leeches from the brain more quickly than any of us would like can be a depressing proposition, no doubt. But you know, this is going to be interesting to watch as it plays through. And certainly as it goes through the House, it is interesting. You know, as we've mentioned, you know, Lynn Ober, who's on the Finance Committee, said, well, you know, we want grants for everybody. You know, Speaker Jasper has been pretty out there suggesting that, you know, he's not keen on full-day kindergarten because he believes it's more about socialization than education, and whether or not that's borne out by, you know, the literature, I don't know. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or visit us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back after a break.
Can't keep up with the news? Try the Civics 101 podcast.
I don't think politics is a dirty word. Politics is our values.
This week on the podcast, from districts to circuits to Supreme, a primer on the federal court system.
Sometimes they have to make decisions that they don't like, but they're upholding their oath to uphold the Constitution.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
We're the first three words in the Constitution. We, the people of the United States.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Now, let's turn to some bills that were before the Senate this week that affected money in politics. The Senate rejected a measure aimed at limiting political donations from limited liability companies, LLCs, controlled by the same person. This is an issue that's come up in, you know, election cycles going back a few cycles now. You know, what was the fight over in this one, Paul?
This is an issue. It's been an issue in a lot of campaigns in recent years. I know there was a spotlight on Ted Gatzis and some of the money he received during his gubernatorial campaign. But the owners of multiple LLCs are allowed to contribute to a single candidate from each of the LLCs to the maximum. And some people say that's a kind of a loophole, and that's a way of getting around the rules. Conservatives argue just the opposite. This bill was spearheaded by Dan Feltes, the liberal Democratic state senator from Concord, and it went down as predicted in the party line vote.
Well, you know, one thing that you're right, this does go back. I mean, you can think back to 2010 when John Stephen ran for governor. He received lots of money from Dunkin' Donut franchises, many out of the same address over the Mass border. Same thing, Kevin Smith, when he ran in 2012, he got, I think, $100,000 out of Dunkin' Donut franchises. You mentioned Ted Gatzis and mm-hmm. money he received by a lot of real estate development
Brady Sullivan,
Stebbins family, Dick Anagnost. I was talking to someone who's, you know, big in real estate development, and he told me that essentially the legal requirements of, you know, developing multiple properties essentially more or less mandate having multiple LLCs, you know, for legal protections. And, you know, he told me he doesn't avail himself of this option. You know, is it surprising that this is very partisan? Because, like, you know, I know Feltes has presented information suggesting that Democrats have benefited by this too. I don't think they've necessarily benefited as conspicuously from, you know, single sources. I mean, does this roll out? Does this boil down to just, you know, who's benefiting, or philosophical issues about what constitutes freedom of speech? A little bit of both.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, but I do think underlying all of these issues, anytime we see these kinds of issues come up in the state legislature, or, you know, at the federal level for that matter, with campaign finance, there is this underlying sort of fundamental philosophical dispute about whether or not money represents free speech. So to the extent that you have these opportunities to donate to candidates, conservatives believe you should be able to do so. Now, it's interesting it sounds like there are also some sort of legitimate business reasons for having multiple limited liability corporations. But, you know, I think it's partly a function of philosophy, but also partly a function of, you know, you can raise a lot of money using these.
Well, why don't we listen to what Andy Sanborn, who kind of led the fight against a state senator from Bedford, said on the Senate floor yesterday. He, by the way, is in real estate development and does have some LLCs himself.
But the sheer thought that a legislative body is going to look and consider separating our people in their legal ability to participate in the electoral process, frankly, is a bridge too high for me.
All right. That was State Senator Andy Sanborn. A bridge too high, he says. You know, another issue touching campaign finance that passed in a less partisan way, and that would broaden the state's reporting requirements to include expenditures made by issue advocacy groups within 60 days in election, assuming their total spending tops $5,000 in a calendar year. What's the significance of that, Paul?
This was an interesting bill because you had Jeb Bradley, the Republican Majority Leader, and four other of his senators joining the Democrats. And maybe this is payback, I guess, against what they felt were some unfair attacks against them in previous election cycles. But yeah, this is now going to treat public advocacy groups, if it becomes law, if it passes the House and is signed by the governor, it'll treat them like it treats candidates, like it treats political action committees, which are the more traditional ways to advertise. Because remember, these advocacy groups, they can criticize, I guess you could say, a candidate by criticizing that candidate's stance on a specific issue rather than going after the candidate themselves. But that still can be perceived by the candidates as a negative attack. Who does this impact the most? Well, in at least New Hampshire, Americans for Prosperity New Hampshire is probably one of the most proficient advocacy groups to take part in this. And of course, Greg Moore, their state director, was definitely didn't agree with this decision.
Well, it's close to kind of see you in court. I mean, I think I've got a statement by him today that essentially he says this legislation would attempt to regulate the political speech of everyone who spends money informing the public about candidates and issues, from companies that invite candidates to meet with employees to chambers of commerce that hold debates to the state's media. This bill, were it to become law, would be challenged in court on First Amendment grounds, ending up in costly litigation. It is interesting. You look at the bill's text and, you know, there may be something. I mean, these, you know, when you're on the losing side of a debate, sometimes your comments can be a bit tendentious. But there may be something to some of his specific concerns about the broadness of this bill that's denied by the bill's lead sponsor, Jeb Bradley.
Right, and even Andy Sanborn, who in the well of the Senate spoke up against this bill, said the same thing. Pretty much that there were protections already written into the Constitution that this bill could be in some ways unconstitutional. But that'll be a case for courts down the road if it becomes law.
And I think too, just to add. You know, in the past, there hasn't been quite very stringent or aggressive oversight of who is even filing these campaign expenditure reports. I think candidates have to file about 6 or 7 before an election comes up. And there's been times where candidates haven't filed on time or they haven't filed at all, even though they were supposed to. And there's not a lot of oversight on that. And the Attorney General's office has been asking for a full-time investigator just to look at these types of problems. Right now they have half a person dedicated to it. The funding has not been granted for that. And so I think unless there is more oversight, requiring more of these reports doesn't necessarily change things if no one is making sure that they're actually coming in.
And these issue advocacy groups, this area of spending has always been notoriously opaque. So I think you can make an argument about transparency that is separate from the issue of whether or not of how and in what ways these groups can target issues and particular candidates. And so, you know, I think people who are pushing for this see this just as kind of a little bit more transparency. Because, you know, it's been amazing to me, you know, having done this in the state for a couple of decades, to see the extent to which this money is now so integral to the political environment here in a way that it just once was not.
Well, to the lifestyle of many political consultants in the state as well.
Sure, absolutely.
One thing, I mean, I think Ali raises a good point, is we talk about enforcement of election laws, we talk about, you know, sort of tightening up some issues around voting and domicile. You know, the issue of putting the money behind the policy is, you know, we're in a budget year. You know, Ali points out Governor Sununu did not stick the money in his proposal to fund what the Attorney General said it wanted. You know, Dan Feltes, who's obviously pretty, you know, loud on the topic of tightening campaign finance, and he had a bill in to put, I think it was like $500,000 to help the Attorney General fund. There's a question about whether or not the Secretary of State might take over some of these responsibilities. Their capacity to do this is something that, you know, is going to be debated down the line.
Yeah, I mean, they do a good job of what they do, but they have limited resources and limited personnel to actually start investigating.
So the Senate acted on some other bills. We're not going to dwell on these, but certainly the dairy bailout, $2 million, just be split proportionately among farmers based on how they were affected by last summer's drought. That is something dairy farmers, the bill got a sort of a haircut, or I guess a sort of a shearing, to use a more sort of agricultural term, as this went through the process. But $2 million, you know, may help dairy farmers.
And that's something with a lot of bipartisan support, both Democrats. I know from the North Country, Jeff Woodburn talked about this a lot and was pretty happy with this vote. Republicans were as well.
The Senate also passed a ban on conversion therapy for minors. That's treatment designed to change a person's sexual orientation. That bill was considered in the past, and I think it was tabled in the House the last time. But there was a similar measure pending in the House, which had a long hearing on the issue this week. You know, this is an issue that came up in Frank Edelblue's confirmation hearings to be education commissioner. He had challenged some of the science used by conversion therapy opponents. This one seems like it's going to pass.
Governor Hassan wanted to sign this last year. You're right. Both chambers did pass this last year, but the language was different. They couldn't come to agreement late in the session, and it was a disappointment for Hassan and a lot of other people. Take two, and you'll have a governor that will probably sign this year.
Another bill heard in that same House committee, the Health Human Services Committee, was a bill that would add gender identity to civil rights laws. It cleared the committee in the House last week, heading to the floor. One of the people who testified at that bill was a young woman named Emily Fishbaugh, a transgender teen from Northampton, who testified on the bill. She spoke with NHPR's Peter Biello earlier this week. Why don't we hear what she said?
I don't want to be discriminated against at work or in housing or anything like that. And I don't want to be kicked out of anywhere just because of my gender identity.
All right, that's Emily Fishbaugh. She lives in Northampton. She testified at the State House on a bill to add gender identity to state civil rights laws. And, you know, this comes at a time when the Trump administration is taking action to rescind an Obama order to schools suggesting that students should be able to use the bathroom of their choice based on their identity. And, you know, my understanding of this bill is that it would not affect schools. It affects housing, employment, and public accommodation. But, you know, obviously this debate is going to continue to play out at the State House and in school districts.
Well, and that was the argument made explicitly by the Trump administration in this move that you mentioned, is that these issues should essentially be decided by individual states.
But the contrast you just made is an important one. This vote, 14-2 in the committee, happened just a few hours before the Trump administration put out their new reading and the scrapping of their federal language. So the contrast between what was happening here in Concord and what was happening in Washington was pretty stark.
Yeah, and the state has been slowly making changes on this front. Governor Hassan, about 6 months before the November election, she signed an executive order that actually bars discrimination within state government of people who are transgender. So this kind of follows on the heels of that executive order. And, you know, the Monitor did a series last summer focused on this, and we talked to a lot of people who are transgender who say that they, you know, after the HB2 passed in North Carolina, and this debate sprung up about bathroom rights and who could use different bathrooms. Transgender people here say they have faced discrimination using the bathroom, and that some are actually fearful of doing that. So I think this bill does address some concerns of transgender people in New Hampshire.
All right, tell us what you think. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. We have an email from Pam from New London. She has a question. How many LLCs does the average voter have? Do any of you control an LLC? I'll go first. I do not control an LLC. Anyone else?
I don't have the money to control an LLC.
No.
Okay.
LLC-free studio.
That's from Pam in New London. We're going to get out of the State House in a minute, but I'm going to turn to you, Paul. Obviously, your news entity has been in the news this week. I know a lot of people listening are going to be curious, what is the future of NH1? No longer going to be on TV, going to persist as a news organization?
It's definitely persisting as a news organization. I'm still living proof that we're covering politics and a lot more. But yeah, you're right. No longer WBIN-TV, which was our TV home, was sold in that FCC spectrum audience. So when it comes to New Hampshire, it's back to being, at least on television, a one newsroom state with WMUR. We're still online at NH1.com, and we're still, of course, on a number of radio stations across the state. So I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing, just on different platforms.
All right. Good to know. Tell us what you think. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. Want to turn to big story that we'll learn the result of quite soon, which is the race for DNC chair. Ray Buckley, New Hampshire's longtime chair, threw his support to Keith Ellison over the weekend, one day after issuing a video of his story. What should we make of this, that Ray Buckley, saw the writing on the wall, thinks Ellison can do the job, had hopes of being kind of the kingmaker in this race?
Yeah, I mean, he has at this point actually endorsed Keith Ellison for chair, and the suggestion has been both from Ray and from Congressman Ellison that their you know, that he would play a sort of a pretty big role in the DNC. I believe he's already the chair of chairs for the Democrats, and so it would be, you know, there would be an augmented role for Ray Buckley in this. You know, this is turned into a pretty big race. People have been raising money. It's sort of a different feel to me than pretty much any party chair race I've seen in the past. And you know, CNN had a debate the other night with seven or eight different candidates, and they're voting this weekend. But you know, the reality is, it looks like it's come down to Keith Ellison and Tom Perez, sort of representing roughly representing the kind of you know, Ellison is sort of the Sanders Warren wing, and Perez the Obama wing, you know. Some people say that's a little too simplistic, but that's kind of how it's been played, right? And so you know, depending on what you believe on Twitter, they each have an advantage here. I've seen stories that say that Perez has the edge, and I've seen others that say that Ellison has the edge. But there's a lot at stake for Democrats in terms of figuring out how to move forward.
We haven't seen this much attention to a national party chair race since Reince Priebus won back in January 11 in his first term. But I think for Ray, it must have hurt a little bit, because Buckley had talked to all of us. I remember being at the convention in Philadelphia last year when the opening first occurred. He was pretty excited about this. This is something he's always wanted to do, and I bet it was a little painful, a little bittersweet for him to realize that the votes were not going to be there. You made a good point. I think he wants to be the kingmaker. It is a risky move, though. If Ellison loses and Perez or somebody else becomes chair, is Buckley's clout in the party, which is pretty sizable, does that diminish?
Well, and not to get too parochial, I mean, it has certainly implications for, you know, you pick the losing side. I mean, you're on the winning side. Obviously, then Ellison had said that, you know, Buckley would have a key role in overseeing or implementing policies where DNC resources would flow to states.
Right.
You know, Buckley's going to keep his job as chairman, which pays pretty handsomely. If he's in the position to be doling out money to states, you know, assuming the New Hampshire Democrats would benefit, you know, you always get the perennial debate over the role the New Hampshire primary plays, and you know, having an inside track there would probably help New Hampshire retain its status. You know, on the flip side, if Perez is in, who knows? But it is interesting to look at Ray Buckley. I mean, in this biographical video, he highlighted
it's pretty comprehensive
his long tenure in Democratic politics, and it's interesting to see someone who, you know, gravitate towards Keith Ellison. I mean, maybe that's where the action is. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, drove around in a car with a PT Cruiser wrapped with Joe Lieberman's face on it for a number of years. He worked for Joe Lieberman's presidential campaign. And, you know, the fact that Buckley would go with Ellison, maybe it's transactional. Maybe it's a sign that that's the direction Democrats are heading, you know, to the left.
Well, and so according to an AP story, at least, Buckley had asked both rivals for control of day-to-day operations of the organization and a hand in the next presidential convention in turn for his support. That's according to the Associated Press. And I think what was interesting is Buckley, you know, ran his campaign largely on helping grow state parties, you know, like what his resume has been here in New Hampshire, that may feel neglected by the DNC organization at the national level. And so I think, you know, if his goal is to play a hand in doing that, you know, maybe that's part of this.
Well, and Ellison's talked about a 57 straight strategy, which would involve all the states plus the territories, a play on Howard Dean's 50-state strategy as chairman.
Which was successful to agree. Democrats did very well in the 6 and 8 cycles. It's interesting. Buckley, very much an insider in the DNC, ran as an outsider to a degree. He was also touting, here's somebody who was kind of tied to Hillary Clinton early in the last election cycle, but he touted that he kept New Hampshire fair and even for Sanders supporters. And, of course, Sanders ended up winning this primary pretty convincingly. Buckley used that as a selling point as he ran.
All right. I understand, Paul, you're going to scurry out to catch up with the town hall that Senator Shaheen and Hassan are having. So you're going to be splitting at the break. But the rest of you, do stick around. There will be more Grant State headlines on the Exchange's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers.
Okay.
can keep up with the news, try the Civics 101 podcast.
I don't think politics is a dirty word. Politics is our values.
This week on the podcast, from districts to circuits to Supreme, a primer on the federal court system.
Sometimes they have to make decisions that they don't like, but they're upholding their oath to uphold the Constitution.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
We're the first three words in the Constitution. We, the people of the United States.
This is the week, the New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or @NHPRExchange at Facebook and Twitter. For the final segment, it's down to Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University and Allie Morris, Concord Monitor. I've got great confidence in our team. Paul was running out to cover this town hall that Senators Hassan and Shaheen are having. Obviously, town hall meetings have been getting a lot of attention during this recess, mostly Republican ones where Obamacare and in New Hampshire's case, Medicaid expansion seem to be on voters' minds. What do you make of this moment in terms of that issue, Dean?
Yeah, it's really fascinating to watch what's going on around the country with a lot of these constituent meetings. This is the President's Day recess. Traditionally, members of Congress go back to their home districts and meet with constituents. It feels a lot like 2009 with the Tea Party rebellion and the opposition to the Affordable Care Act. But now this time, it's interesting to watch kind of the public opinion swing a bit, and there are people who are actually very concerned about what is going to replace Obamacare if it's repealed. There's a little bit of immigration stuff mixing in as well in there as well with the executive order, and it's been particularly tough on Republicans. Number have been skipping their constituency meetings or doing it, a telemeeting or some other sort of technology to avoid being there in person. There's the usual criticism, and we heard this from Democrats in 2009 that this is sort of, manufactured. It's all organized and paid for. There may be some of that, but also some of it feels like it's organic. And so, we have here in the state today, we have Senators Shaheen and Hassan meeting, having a town hall meeting over at New Hampshire Technical Institute. And they're obviously going to be sort of on the other side of things, talking about how to preserve healthcare, the current system. So, this is a pretty big moment. Question among Democrats is this energy that we're seeing something that will actually have an impact on electoral outcomes in the midterm? Will the energy last? Will it happen in places where there's an opportunity to pick up seats in the House and Senate? We don't know that yet.
Well, and in terms of healthcare, we obviously don't know exactly what's coming out of Washington. Right. And
which is part of the criticism and anxiety you're seeing from voters.
And we don't know what the state is going to do necessarily with the continuation of Medicaid expansion. Governor Sununu has said it's going to wait, at least as far as he's concerned, until next year, Allie.
Yeah, definitely. And I just say add one thing onto what Dean said. I think what's interesting about this town hall this morning is that Senator Shaheen and Senator Hassan come to New Hampshire as two of the biggest critics of Donald Trump. Senator Hassan in her first term, it's been about a month and a half for her in office, got a lot of national attention when she questioned his education nominee, Betsy DeVos. And Senator Shaheen has really become one of the leading opponents among Senate Democrats of some of Donald Trump's controversial policies, like the ban on travel and some of the findings about Russia. She's called for hearings looking into that. So I think it'll be an interesting look at where they think the administration is going and what type of stance they will take going forward.
And, it ought to be said, both of them, and, there is certainly a kind of ritual knee-jerk criticism of politicians on, I'm not sure any politician can hold – if anyone ever says you're sort of something holding enough town halls as a politician, you're probably holding too many and sort of wearing them out. So, but they've both been criticized by Republicans for being inaccessible in a town hall forum. It'll be interesting to see, it'll be interesting to see if Republicans, manage to get into this event. It'll be interesting to see, what their demeanor is. But Allie is definitely right that since Governor Hassan became Senator Hassan, she's been pretty much, full force, against you know, Trump, by and large, I mean, she has voted for some of his confirmation picks, but she obviously, you know, kind of trimmed her sails a bit differently, as one would as governor. But you know, in sure. first year in a term, you know, 6 years is a long time. A lot of it is sort of making a name for yourself, setting up opportunities to raise money, you know, standing up for what you believe in, no doubt.
And it's just different being one member of a party caucus in the Senate rather than the chief executive. And, you know, this is sort of fairly typical opposition party behavior in Congress. I've mentioned before, Senator Shaheen in particular really is sort of stepping forward as a leader of the opposition in a way that I haven't seen in the past. I mean, she sort of would sort of pop up for particular issues where you could draw kind of a clear link to New Hampshire. But now, you know, I see her and to a lesser extent Senator Hassan, you know, on the cable news channels, you know, going after Trump and talking about a lot of the policy in a way that I haven't really seen before.
And I would agree with you, Josh. I mean, I think it's interesting to note both women, Shaheen and Hassan, were slammed by Republicans during their recent election campaigns for not holding town halls. I mean, people would show up at Senator Shaheen's events dressed as a chicken, holding a sign, "Too chicken for town halls." I think the New Hampshire GOP had a clock on their website this past election when Hassan was running for Senate, counting the days since her last town hall meeting. So, you know, they have to some extent become a political football in New
Hampshire.
Well,
and whether or not,
politics.
You know, and I was trying to think back, you know, prior to the spate of town halls during this kind of nascence of the Tea Party, you know, when did it become, obviously, public servants need to interact with the public, but when did it become a requirement that essentially one kind of like walk a plank and, you know, have the equivalent of like rotten fruit tossed at them by constituents. and that seems to be, you know, increasingly an expectation. And, you know, you're a public servant. You kind of get what you pay for.
And I will say, and I talk about this all the time, I talk about it in my classes, the impact of technology to bring people together, whether it's sort of formal political organization or simply letting people know who are interested, what's going on and when a town hall meeting is going to be. You know, everybody's recording this stuff on their phones and it goes viral immediately. It's just a fundamentally different information environment politically than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, and to fight about what constitutes a town hall, and obviously there's the capacity with this technology to have all sense of what you could call almost kind of pop-up town halls where, you know, as a reporter, sometimes you learn, oh, so-and-so is having a town hall like in Lisbon. You know, you're not going to be able to get there, and, you know, nor necessarily are voters that are not pre-invited, but that's the reality of politics.
And now, you know, now citizens can use their smartphones and kind of capture a member of Congress who, you know, comes out of a doorway and is suddenly asked, you know, how come you're not meeting with constituents? You know, there's a whole range of tactics and strategy that we see now that we just didn't see in the past because of the impact of digital technology.
And I would say our most recent high-profile town hall was when then-candidate Donald Trump came to southern New Hampshire and had a town hall meeting right before that debate that was in the town hall format. And his choice of town hall was with a moderator who asked written questions from the audience.
That was a very hot night. I think we were both there. There was
That's
nice.
Right, I remember
it was
that,
a
yeah.
sort of wood panel.
Exactly.
You know, I think it was in Sandown. Uh-huh. Hard to get to.
It was very hot.
You know, nice event. But it is true. There were signs on the wall saying, you know, essentially write your questions. And, you know, he had radio host Howie Carr as the moderator. He won't be on hand for Senators Shaheen and Hassan. Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. I want to get out of politics for a moment and talk a little bit about Owen LaBrie, St. Paul School former St. Paul student who's back in court this week in Concord seeking a new trial. He was acquitted on felony sex assault charges in 2015, but convicted of statutory rape of a fellow student and endangering the welfare of the child, which were misdemeanors. Most crucial to what was going on this week, though, was his conviction on a felony charge of using a computer to solicit a minor for sex. That felony would require LaBrie to register as a sex offender for life. You know, this case has, you know, it has its tabloid aspects, but right now it's also one that could potentially set a precedent in terms of how sex cases are handled in a small way, couldn't it, Dean?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me to see what we essentially had was a 3-day trial in which LaBrie's current lawyers cross-examined his previous lawyers about how they handled his case. And sort of as you mentioned, the kind of the core of the issue here, I think, for LaBrie is this use of the computer to set up the date with the student, and whether or not that falls under this sort of anti-stalking legislation that requires him to now register for life as a sex offender. And I think that there was some argument from his current lawyers and from him that the previous lawyers did not take this head on in the way that they should have, that they didn't really do their homework on this. There's also a larger debate about, whether someone like him was the sort of the intended target of this legislation. My understanding was it was really more about, grown men contacting young girls over the internet.
Well, there's a very technical question about whether this would apply to, there's kind of an intranet versus
exactly.
intranet.
So
and this, because
right.
this communication yeah. took place on a closed system at St. Paul's
School. I think in the earlier trial, they made the argument that at some point late in the game that this should not have applied to him, but it was not persuasive. And so, yeah, basically his previous lawyers are now were essentially on trial for the defense.
Well, why don't we listen to what his most well-known previous lawyer, J.W. Carney, a Boston defense attorney who he used to defend him, what he said when he was on the stand talking about the line he tried to walk as he did what he said was his best to defend LaBrie in his trial.
There were a number of references throughout the discovery of other women whom Owen had dated in which he had acted in ways, according to the women, that were very aggressive, that were forceful.
That was J.W. Carney, Owen LaBrie's attorney, at his first trial talking about how he tried to walk the line in not opening the door to evidence that could have been detrimental to his client. Now, this there's an element of this that's taking place at Merrimack County Superior Court. Excuse me. There's another avenue at the Supreme Court. Owen LaBrie was sentenced to, was it a year? And so,
he's currently technically out on bail because of all the appeal and the request of a new trial is all sort of forestalling that 1 year. But again, the bigger issue, I think, for him is this sort of lifetime registration as a sex offender because of the use of the computer to set up the meeting.
And that of a registration was required because, in some sense, because he went to trial. I mean, there were apparently plea deals offered that wouldn't have made him susceptible to that conviction, which he opted not to take. Obviously, there's civil trial against St. Paul's School brought by the young woman who is LaBrie's victim. That's going to be taking place this spring at federal court, assuming there's not some sort of settlement reached. So this issue is going to continue to get a lot of attention.
Well, and what's interesting about what's going on now is it sort of lays bare and kind of opens up for people to see how these cases are litigated and what types of strategies people take. Carney said in court that he wanted to limit evidence from these witnesses who basically, he said, would have corroborated what the victim said. And I also wonder, if this now opens the door to some of that coming in on appeal. It's just an interesting case all around.
All right. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpro.org. I mentioned that we're going to stay away from politics for a moment. I broke that promise. I do want to touch briefly before we go on Governor Sununu's visit to Washington this weekend for the meeting of the National Governors Association. There'll be also a meeting of the Republican Governors Association. He's going to get in a group some FaceTime with President Trump. One thing on the table is going to be Medicaid expansion, the future of Medicaid, block grants. Allie, this is something a lot of people at the State House are thinking about. Mm-hmm. We don't really know where it's headed. What do you imagine we're going to learn out of this weekend?
So this relates to expanded Medicaid in New Hampshire in some ways. The legislature has been sort of doing a stop-start with Medicaid, where they reauthorize it every 2 years and then kind of throw it up in the air about what are we going to do? Is this going to proceed? And right now, expanded Medicaid continues through 2018, but what happens next is a huge question mark. And part of that is, Republicans in Congress in Washington have advocated these so-called Medicaid block grants, which Republicans here in the state say they really like. And it would basically give these money to the states to distribute as they see fit to the Medicaid populations. And Republicans like this because they're often frustrated with certain strings and restrictions that the federal government puts on Medicaid money that are sort of out of the state's hands but can really drive up the state's costs.
Some Republicans like them, some don't. I mean, the fear with block grants is you're getting a finite amount of money and, you know, circumstances can change.
Right.
And if it runs out, and, you know, certainly Governor Sununu has been very bullish on these. I've followed him around as he's talked to Chamber of Commerce's and those sorts of speeches. And he always presents block grants, you know, as an unalloyed great thing for New Hampshire. He always says, well, you know, it kind of depends on what it ends up being, which, you know, something any sane person would say. But, you know, the possibility of enhancing freedom for policymakers to craft a policy is something that has been appealing. I mean, this came up in the Bush administration. Tommy Thompson, as Health and Human Services Secretary, you know, pushed block grants. Then Commissioner John Steven sought flexibility to implement what he then called Granite Care, which never flew. You know, Republicans take control again. This issue comes up again. But, you know, there are a lot of question marks as well, Dean.
Yeah, you know, for me, block grants are back to the future. They go back all the way to the Reagan administration and the push for devolving power to the states and the new federalism movement. And the idea basically is that you minimize the strings attached. The idea philosophically is that each state or region knows what's in its own best interest in terms of the specifics of policy. You know, Democrats have argued it makes sort of accountability and measuring impact a little bit more difficult. But, yeah, Governor Sununu has been a big proponent of that in terms of continuing on with the Medicaid.
But I guess the question is, are we at a political moment with Republicans in control in Washington, with a president who's down for this, with you know, the specter of a repeal of Obamacare, wanting to cover people who are covered without the revenues and the taxes attached to Obamacare? Lots of competing priorities in Washington. Some, you know, kind of right-leaning people I've been talking to in Washington really see this as a moment when it might happen. There's obviously going to be a lot of talk this weekend about that. We'll see what the governor comes back with. We're almost out of time. What are you folks going to be focusing on in the near term, Allie?
We are looking at mental health in the Granite State and some of the rising wait lists to get into New Hampshire Hospital, the state psych board.
All right. Dean?
Tuesday night, President Trump is giving his first address to a joint session of Congress. I'm going to be sitting in for Laura here on the Exchange Tuesday morning. We're going to do a show on Trump's on the federal budget and Trump's budget priorities. So it should be pretty interesting.
All right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Thanks all who have participated. Have a good weekend. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.